Dr. L. John Schreiner has been a radiation therapy physicist since 1986, when he joined the medical physics unit directed by Dr. Irvin Podgorsak at McGill University in Montreal. In 1997, after 10 years at McGill and the Montreal General Hospital, and about 2 years at the Vancouver Island Cancer Center, he became the chief medical physicist at the Cancer Center of Southeastern Ontario in Kingston, Ontario. He is cross-appointed as adjunct professor in the departments of oncology and physics, engineering physics and astronomy, and has an appointment to the School of Computing at Queen's University. He has been board certified by the Canadian College of Physicists in Medicine as both a member and fellow. Dr. Schreiner currently holds the position of president for the charitable organization Medical Physics for World Benefit. MPWB was established in December 2014 and became formally incorporated in Canada in June of 2015, and later in the United States in 2016. The organization envisions a world with access to effective and safe applications of physics and technology in medicine. Their mission is to support activities which will yield effective and safe use of physics and technologies in medicine through advising, training, demonstrating, and/or participating in medical physics-related activities, especially in low- to middle-income countries. In today's episode, Dr. Ramsey and Dr. Schreiner discuss global oncology, medical physics for world benefit's role in the medical community, as well as the economic and social hurdles associated with providing quality care in low to middle income countries.
Hello, Dr. Schreiner. Welcome, and thank you so much for being here today.
Well, hello, Eric, and thank you very much for the invite. It's quite an honor to be asked to do a podcast with Versant. I've listened to the last few and really, really enjoyed them. So I hope today is entertaining for your listeners. And Eric, please call me John.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. I have no doubt that this is going to be an excellent podcast also, John. So before we get started, over here in the U.S., we now have the coronavirus running for a year. It looks like things are going to be getting better soon enough, but how are things in Canada, especially where you are?
Things have been going quite well in Canada. We were fortunate at the onset that politicians at all levels of government, federal, provincial, and municipal, aligned well on recommended actions and kind of were in lockstep on what they wanted to do. In particular, we've done very well in Kingston. We had a very strong medical officer of health who was quite aggressive on suggesting some actions, and people were very compliant here, so we've done well. We're a retirement city. A lot of folk retire in Kingston, and we're also a university town. So we have quite a diverse population, and we've had very few cases. So, you know, about 700 cases throughout the whole COVID hit. Most of them since December up to about a month ago. So, you know, that's pretty good. Only one death in the city. So we've been handling it quite well. We just came out of a lockdown last week, and so things are opening up a little bit again, and life hopefully we'll be back to normal in the summer.
Oh, that's good news, good news. So, John, you've had a long and productive career in medical physics. So were you disposed towards physics even as a small boy, as I was? Or did you come to it later in life more as a decision for a career? Or was there a particular person that you met along the way that convinced you physics was the way to go?
A bit of all of that, Eric. To be honest, I always thought I wanted to be a scientist of some sort, not that I really understood what that meant, but science always intrigued me. My parents had given me quite a few scientific gifts as I was growing up. I had a chemistry set, an unusual thing. I had a model Van de Graaff generator that made static experiments, static electricity experiments. And, you know, we had encyclopedias and I had a microscope. So I was always interested in science, and my parents encouraged that. But I didn't really know about physics until high school. In grades 10 and 11, I had two amazing physics teachers, Mr. Boyle and Mr. Bent, who took high school physics from the boring and made it very mysterious and intriguing. And so I was always keen on the physical sciences. So I, when I went to college and then university at McGill, I did both my college and university at McGill University in Montreal. I kind of concentrated on the physical sciences. So physics wasn't really an active career choice, but it was something that I was comfortable with and slowly moved to it as I was going through my undergrad. Although I can say a buddy I roomed with in my last year at McGill that I'd known since high school said to me a couple of years ago when we were chatting that I was one of the only people he knew that was doing exactly what he said he wanted to do in high school. So I guess I was always looking this way in some way.
Right. Well, you and I both did our studies at McGill. And I have to tell you, those were the best days of my life. My wife doesn't like me saying that, but I really enjoyed my time there very much. What did you do for your PhD precisely, and what was the reason for whatever the choice was?
Well, this is going to be a little bit of a long story, hopefully not too long. I did my PhD in biophysics, and I got into it through a bit of an indirect path. My bachelor's in McGill was in honors physics, which was a program that was trying to direct the students to graduate school. So it was really set to send you to grad school. I was not the best student in the class. We started with 45 students. We ended up with 11. And part of why I made it through was in the last year, the group decided we would not have any more attrition and that all 11 of us would make it through. So we helped each other understand the content of the courses, and we really worked together to help and make sure everybody got out. When I was in my last term and I was applying to grad schools, I was picking different fields at different universities. I was doing kind of a trial by God, and I applied to a couple of schools for astronomy, a couple of schools for laser physics, one for biophysics, and I also applied to one for medical physics at the University of Edmonton. I knew about medical physics because I had a friend who had volunteered at the Jewish General Hospital. And when she was going to her station, she would pass by this office that had a name on it and the label medical physicist under the name. So she told me about this and I looked into the field. So I knew that there were physicists in hospitals, and that intrigued me a little bit, but I wasn't really pointed that way. So I applied to these different schools, but as I said, I wasn't the greatest student. And in my last term, my marks were such that only, I think only Edmonton did accept me. But in the interim, I had applied to the University of Waterloo to do some summer research position. And I was accepted. And so I went to the University of Waterloo the summer I graduated and worked in a nuclear magnetic resonance lab under Professor Mick Pintar. Mm-hmm. And that was quite intriguing. I spent the whole summer measuring the NMR relaxation times of tissue. We would get 30 sample tubes every week from the University of Western Ontario from Dr. Inch. And these tubes contained various mouse tissues, some from healthy mice and some from mice that had had a tumor implanted, usually on the hind leg. And we were trying to see if we could diagnose the cancer from the NMR relaxation times. So that was kind of a hot topic. This would have been in the mid-70s. So, you know, I was working in this lab for 2 months. I was doing quite well. And as that job ended, it was time to apply again to see if I'd go to a master's or not. And I decided to take a year off. But Dr. Pintar heard this and he said, well, why don't you just stay with us here? And so he actually managed to get me into the University of Waterloo, and that went quite well, and I stayed there the next 7 years and finished my PhD.
How did you go from there to your work in radiation oncology?
Eric, this, again, is a little bit of a story. While I was at Waterloo, one of the strengths of Mick Pintar's program was that he had a regular biannual winter school that he ran at the university, and it would bring experts in nuclear magnetic resonance together with about 50 or 60 graduate students and the postdoctoral fellows. So it was a very intimate meeting, and in the people he would bring in, there were some of the stars of nuclear magnetic resonance, Irvin Hahn and Charles Schlichter and John Waugh. And also he brought in a couple of times Paul Lauterbur and Peter Mansfield, who were developing this imaging technique called the magnetic resonance imaging, and who would later win the Nobel Prize. So very early in the development of MRI, I was seeing the application and seeing the development of the field. So I graduated with a little bit of knowledge about this nuclear magnetic resonance and its application in medicine. As I finished my degree, I was looking for work, and it just happened that Professor Irvin Podgorshak, who was the chief of medical physics at the Montreal General Hospital, and who I believe introduced you to medical physics at the start of your career, reached out to Mick Pintar to see if he had a student coming out that had some knowledge of MR. And the link there was that Mick and Irvin were both Slovenians, and they had known each other in the University of Ljubljana years earlier. So I applied for a position at the Montreal General Hospital, and I was hired at the time to join the group in diagnostic radiology. And the motivation there at the time was, in the early days of MRI, you really needed a physicist on board to help the radiologists interpret the images and to help set up imaging sequences and to set up the equipment. So a physicist was a very important part of implementing MRI in a hospital. After I'd been with the group for about a year, it was clear that funding for a machine would not happen for another 4 or 5 years, just the way funding for equipment is in many public-supported healthcare systems. And so it was clear that what I had been brought in for might not come to fruition very quickly. And at the same time, Irvin had a position at McGill for an academic medical physicist in radiation oncology. And he asked me to apply for that position. And I was fortunate to get the position, and which meant a move to radiation therapy physics. At the time, most of my colleagues thought I was crazy. My fellow students from the past thought I was a little bit crazy moving from a dying field, radiation therapy, into a hot field of magnetic resonance imaging. As you and I know, radiation therapy has definitely not been a dying field. It is an exciting and ongoing field, and serves many, many patients extremely well. So that worked out for me.
Yeah. What I will say is that for whatever reason, it was a hidden field. After I finished my PhD, I hadn't even heard of medical physics. And again, it was by an accidental visit by Irvin to our department that I got involved. And in fact, I didn't mention this at the start of the podcast, but you and I met back, I think, in 1987. when you were with Irvin. So that's quite a while ago.
Yeah, quite a while ago. But again, I think you would agree with me that being an oncology medical physicist is about one of the most rewarding fields that a physicist could get involved with. It's challenging. One has to keep up with ever-changing technology and a lot of physics. And yet at the same time, we are benefiting people directly every day that we're in the clinic.
Well, excellent story. And I think that the way things worked out was perfect for you, John, because you have been recognized and honored by both universities as well as professional organizations for your work over the years. What accomplishments would you say stand out the most for you?
So a friend once told me that I had needed help for the best work that he thought I'd ever done. And the best work was raising my three daughters, and the help was from my wife, Heather. And I think if I look at the highlights of my career, they've been more or less the same. A highlight has been able to work with some excellent colleagues over a career just over three decades, and some excellent students, and really have that interaction and work together. I'm quite proud that many of the students that I was involved with, I was able to help them move ahead in their careers. Quite a few of my students have been the heads of clinics in the US of A and up here in Canada. They've done very well for themselves, and many of my students became very strong clinical medical physicists, and there are many cancer patients that have benefited from their getting out in the clinic. So I'm very proud of the fact that I've helped quite a few people get into the field. Also introduced many undergraduate students to the field. As you know, medical physics 20 years ago wasn't really that well known a field. And so if you could recruit some people in there, that was actually achieving quite a bit. And I've even had a few students who heard me give talks at their university who went into medical physics. So I'm quite proud of that. These students have helped me establish a pretty strong career. I've had a lot of fun in my research over the years. And part of when I became a medical physicist, mm-hmm. coming from an NMR background and moving into radiation physics, there was a new field that was coming up at the time that was called the three-dimensional dosimetry, where you could irradiate a material, change its properties because of the radiation, and read that out over a volume and get the dose distribution in a volume of material. And the early days of that was the readout was usually with NMR. So I got into this field very early on have actually introduced many scientists in Canada and in the United States into the field. And we've actually formed a very active community, and that's been, a source of pride. Also, we started a series of international conferences mm-hmm. in 1999. The first one was in Kentucky with Jeff Ibbett. And over the years, we've had these conferences every 2 years, and we've published over nearly 500 preferred papers and over 100 review papers in the proceedings of this conference that are all open access. So that's been, that was a very exciting career to have, to bring this field forward a little bit and to interest quite a few good scientists into doing the investigations for this dosimetry.
Excellent, John. Well, I believe you're now formally retired as a medical physicist, but I suspect that you're just as busy as ever, because you're now president for an organization named Medical Physics for World Benefit, otherwise known as MPWB. Why don't you tell us what this organization is and how it got started?
Okay, I'll start a little bit by saying how I got interested in some of the issues that MPWB is concerned about. It was during my time in Kingston, in my last position here, the last 20 years, that I began to understand that there were some issues with the equity of radiation delivery throughout the world. And I kind of got into that a little bit backwards. When I first came to Kingston, we had a number of old linear accelerators, the main high energy treatment units that we use in the clinic, but they were of a previous generation and they weren't able to do some of the radiation deliveries that modern techniques are based on. So we had an old cobalt unit in the clinic, and so we started to see if we could do modern dose deliveries with this cobalt unit, essentially building a benchtop jig and doing all kinds of experiments using a technique, to use the jargon, Eric, that you would know, it's intensity modulated radiation therapy. And we showed that actually this cobalt unit was able to achieve some very nice dose deliveries. And we decided to present this work at a conference at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna in 2009. And at that conference, there were participants from around the world. And it was there that I really saw the struggle that many countries have in doing modern radiation therapy. So, you know, I started to see that there were global problems. I also had a colleague, Chandra Joshi in Kingston, who was originally from India, and he introduced me to the Indian medical physics community. So I did a few trips there and again could see what a variation of treatment capabilities there were in the world. So, you know, I've been interested in global problems. And when retirement was coming up, I was invited to get involved with this organization, Medical Physics for World Benefit. And it's a relatively new organization. It was launched in 2014. Formally incorporated both in Canada in 2015 and in the United States in 2016. And its intent is to support global access to safe and effective applications of physics and technology in medicine. Its activities are intended to apply to all areas of medical physics, not just radiation therapy. But to be honest, most of the activities of the organization to date have been directed to oncology physics. So again, the motivation for the organization is this huge disparity in healthcare between high income countries and low to middle income countries. And these disparities are often manifested in the treatment or lack of treatment, I guess, of major diseases, especially cancer. The incidence of cancer in lower income countries is growing much more rapidly than high income countries. So that really exacerbates the problem, I guess.
Right. So who actually started the organization, John?
Well, our founding father was Jake Van Dyke from Western University in London, Ontario. Jake served for many years also on the International Atomic Energy Agency in various capacities. And he was a consultant for quite a few years in Vienna from 2009 to 2011 and saw the IAEA's efforts directed towards providing support and increasing global capacity for radiation medicine. And he saw how that was being directed to low and middle income countries. While he was at the IAEA, Jake came to learn of an organization called Physiciens Médicaux Sans Frontières, which was a French-based organization, a little bit like Doctors Without Borders, whose mission was to aid the support of cancer in developing countries, cancer treatment in developing countries. But they weren't well known in the English-speaking world. And Jake proposed setting up an English-speaking sister organization, which was he thought would be called Medical Physics for Without Borders. But after a request from Doctors Without Borders, we changed the name to Medical Physics for World Benefit.
Just curiously, why would they object? Because of confusion, maybe? People would be confused between the two societies?
I think what it might have been in part is there are quite a few organizations called Without Borders. So there's even a Clowns Without Borders. But I think part of the issue is physicien, which is physicist. And doctor gets very confused when English speakers see the French names and vice versa. So I think they were very concerned that with it being medical physicists, there would be this confusion with physicians. And so they asked for us to make sure that confusion didn't happen.
Sure, absolutely. With regards to MPWB, John, can you give us a brief history of the organization?
So I mentioned already that the start was really the brainchild of Jake Van Dyke from London, Canada. So he saw the need for this organization that would be more focused on helping extend good medical physics throughout the world. And I first heard of the organization in 2011. Jake was receiving a gold medal for his outstanding career from the Canadian Organization of Medical Physicists. And at the award ceremony, as he was talking about his career and his future, he announced that he was interested in developing an organization that would be devoted to ensuring strong medical physics globally. And the response to that announcement was very enthusiastic. And in the next few annual meetings of COMP and of the American Association of Physicists in Medicine, he described his dream of this organization. That's where we went. That's how it really came to be formed. Jake knew of my interests in global oncology, because of many conversations we had over the years. And as past president, one of the roles is to nominate future board members. And he approached me and asked if I would be interested in getting involved in the organization. So I had known a little bit of the organization. I had been involved with some early conversations with him, if this would be viable or not, what I thought, if physicists would be interested in such an organization. And it was clear there is a lot of interest. People are more and more concerned in extending radiation therapy globally. And that does require a strong medical physics input. And when he asked me if I would get involved, I was very happy to say yes. Eric, I should also say Medical Physics for World Benefit is really trying to extend medical physics in all aspects. So we do have members that are in radiation safety. We do have members who have been more involved in diagnostic imaging, in nuclear medicine, and in radiation oncology. But up to now, much of our focus has been on radiation oncology because that is really an area of great concern, extending radiotherapy to cancer patients around the world. So it is a broad organization, but some of our focus up to date has been very much for radiation oncology physics.
I see. So what is the organizational structure of MPWB? How is it funded, and how many members are there currently in the organization?
Well, we have a volunteer board of directors that takes care of the governance of the organization, and up to now has been taking care of much of the day-to-day operational activities of the organization. We're funded mainly through membership funds, membership fees, and from donations from the community. We are an official charitable organization in both Canada and the United States, so we have been getting donations quite regularly. We have over 230 full members. To be a full member, you have to be a medical physicist with the appropriate evidence of training and certification, employment, and so you need to have the appropriate medical physics background. And then we have about 55 associate members, and these are medical physics residents and trainees, graduate students, and such.
So the scope of activities of medical physics for world benefit, the world is huge. How do you choose where to apply your efforts, given that the demand for any organization such as yours must be truly very large, and you can't solve all the problems in the world? So how do you decide where and how to apply whatever resources you possess?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, to date, much of the initial work, especially up to 2018, of the organization was actually setting the organization up. We had founding board members that spent considerable efforts to get the corporation up within the appropriate guidelines in Canada and the United States. We had to establish this charitable status, establish links to other medical physics and global oncology organizations, setting up a web presence to make sure that the organization was visible and such. So there was a lot of organizational work at the beginning. It might seem that such efforts are mundane and may have detracted from our main mission, but in fact, it's work that needs to be done if you want to get an organization off the ground. And it was took a lot of effort, but it was effort that needed to happen. As the organization did get known, it started to receive, as you suggest, a lot of ad hoc requests for assistance from multiple individuals and groups, perhaps trying to set up cancer centers or cancer radiation programs or training programs in low and middle income countries. And these ad hoc requests often were to deal with specific problems in the clinic, perhaps after the receipt of a piece of equipment or such. So the MPWB board would try to reply to these queries and to connect folk asking for the assistance with experts that we knew could help provide some guidance. Often these were other medical physics for world benefit members, but sometimes not. So, you know, there's been a lot of ad hoc work, and I think we've been in communication with over 25 countries over the last little while. To give you just a couple of examples of things we did, we had a request at one point from the Rotary Club of Canada, a particular in a particular city that had a link with a city in Uganda, and they wanted to help establish a cancer center and a radiation center, and they wanted our assistance to help organize a needs analysis trip. We've collaborated with the AAPM and the International Organization of Medical Physics equipment donation programs, where they wanted to provide some dosimetry equipment to a center in Mexico. And we had planned a visit to that center to help them take on some used dosimetry, dose measurement equipment, so that they could, adopt that. And we actually had that trip fully organized and everything was going to go. And then COVID hit. And so that hasn't quite happened. So those are the kinds of things we've done, and quite a few others, actually.
Okay. So essentially, MPWB is somewhat new. You have your infrastructure in place. You have your governance board, but you're just now getting off and running, so to speak. You keep mentioning LMICs, low to middle income countries, and it so happens that at the last ASTRO meeting, this was one of the major themes of that meeting under the heading of global oncology. So it seems like MPWB is fitting in very nicely to what has become a very important topic for the leaders of our industry right now. Are there activities that you can point to that MPWB is engaged in today with LMICs or soon to be? And do you feel that with what you have been able to do so far, that it has really made a difference?
So we have learned a lot from our past experience that's helping us to figure out how we can best work now and in the future. So what we found from our initial projects is, in quite a few cases, communication was slow and intermittent. And sometimes the motivation for a project would change as situations changed, often situations changing in the countries we were trying to help. There'd be new staff in a center, new leadership at a university, perhaps new government. And so it became difficult sometimes to know how a project was moving forward. So this experience has informed MPWB's response when choosing projects to support. We now work to establish upfront that there is a long-term commitment at the location that is asking for help. And we probe carefully at the beginning to make sure we better understand what the situation is in that center and how we are being asked to help. We've also made it much clearer for folk approaching us what we can and we cannot do. So we've had to clarify with people asking for help that there are certain things we can do. We can provide intellectual support through collaborative education, through training, through mentoring, and things that we cannot do. So we cannot provide funds for a project. We will not engage in trying to find equipment donations. So we do not solicit for that kind of stuff. Although we're very happy, as I said, to support related training initiatives as they're appropriate. So that's kind of guided the decisions we've made on the projects that we can work with. So we now have a number of particular projects that we're trying to work with. They are often in conjunction with other organizations. So I think one of the ways we've made a difference is that we are working with other organizations to try and help focus sometimes their international interests. We believe that we have an advantage over bigger organizations such as the AAPM, the Canadian Organization of Medical Physics, and the International Organization of Medical Physics, because they have a much broader scope. They are trying to do many things, and their international outreach is often something they're very interested in, but they can't devote all of their focus and activities to those things. So we can help them in some of these international projects. And I think you mentioned that, you know, these organizations are interested in this and how are we different. The difference is in many ways the way that we can help focus some of the items. So just to give you a sense of two of the big projects that we're working on right now, we have a couple of targeted initiatives, especially directed towards medical physics training in low and middle income countries, where there are challenges often in training a medical physicist, either because they do not have the resources and the equipment and the time available to do the training, and often because the trainers are not really there. So two of the projects that are ongoing right now, one is what we call the Open Syllabus Project for medical physics trainees. And it's a project where we've had a number of experts help to capture the core elements in medical physics training from various professional groups, from regulatory groups, from various organizations such as the International Atomic Energy Agency, and look at some of their resources. And we're curating the syllabus content. So we're helping to define and select and collect material which can be used in an open syllabus kind of learning environment. We're publishing this syllabus, and we are making it openly accessible on the MPWB website, along with web links to other educational resources that can be used to meet the learning objectives. And then we're partnering with various organizations in how we develop this open the syllabus. One of the things we're trying to overcome is often the training materials and the reports and such that a trainee can use in their in his or her formation are restricted. They're behind paywalls, or they require library access. And what we're trying to establish is this open environment where all of these materials will be readily available to somebody who is in a training program in their center, in their country, and they just want to have access to the tools to move forward.
Right, I understand. Can I just interject a quick question, John? In the United States, you know, the route to being a medical physicist it's very different from when I started back in the late 80s, and same with you. But now you have to have a graduate degree in medical physics at a CAMPEP-approved institution, followed by a CAMPEP-approved residency program, followed by board exams, which complete after a few years of being a working physicist. I don't imagine that this sort of schedule is possible to emulate in full in the LMICs. And your open syllabus program, how close does that align with the way we do things here in the US and in Canada today?
Well, as you say, the path to a medical physicist to becoming a medical physicist is quite well defined in North America, for sure, through this requirement from the Commission for the Accreditation of Medical Physics Education Programs that you mentioned, CAMPEP. In fact, the way you and I came into the field, Eric, kind of through the back door from associated PhDs in high energy physics and in NMR, that path is very difficult these days. I suspect no one can come quite into the field that way. So that is a struggle. And in North America, as you say, these training requirements are very restrictive. And very few LMICs have the resources to provide such a comprehensive training. In many countries, medical physicists have been trained on the job. In many countries, the medical physicists only have a bachelor's degree, so they don't have the full academic credentials that we would require of a trainer here. So qualified trainers, they're just not available. And in many of the cancer centers in low and middle income countries, the facilities are worked to the maximum. They are training long day, or they're treating long days, and there is little time for training on the treatment units and in the clinic. So, you know, this makes it very difficult. And some of the other requirements for training, you know, the having specific equipment, having treatment planning systems and computerized systems that they need to be trained on, they're just not there. So where this open syllabus is trying to help is we are not setting the training path. The training path has to be set by the clinic or the country that is trying to bring up their medical physics resources. So that's something they have to set. They have to set that appropriately. But what the open syllabus is there to do is once they have set, you know, a certain syllabus they want their trainees to go through, that there are no barriers to the to finding information, finding to the resources that the trainee needs to move forward. So we're not trying to set up a training program, but we're trying to make the tools that the trainees need available to them. So that's our goal. Other groups such as the International Atomic Energy Agency, the International Organization of Medical Physics, they are trying to help guide what these training programs will look like. For example, the Federation of African Medical Physics Organization has recommendations for medical physics education in African member states. And so, you know, we feel that it's these organizations that need to figure out what the appropriate training for their centers are. But what we're trying to do is make an environment where the trainees have as much assistance as they can that they might not get from their local setting. Another thing that we're setting up right now is a virtual mentoring program. And we've just set up the project plan and a working group to establish a mentorship program. In the past, we always thought this mentorship would be done by people going to countries and spending a few weeks and helping train people up. But perhaps there's been one good thing out of COVID, Eric, in that we are much more comfortable in working remotely. Everybody's getting used to Zoom meetings or go-to meeting sessions, even Skype, as a way to exchange information. And what we're going to try and do is set up the ability for mentors in high-income countries and also in low- and middle-income countries, because they have a lot that they can teach us too, and mentees from various countries where they can meet one-on-one through some program where they've been matched through Medical Physics for World Benefit, and where the mentorship is through a well-established program with certain expectations, and we'll actually be monitoring how progress goes. So that's something else we're trying to set up where, again, we can help the individuals that are coming up to speed. The other thing we think that a mentorship program can do is, I'm sure, Eric, in your career, one of the strengths of being in a center is that you have other medical physics colleagues that you can bounce ideas off of and talk to as you're working through problems. In many low and middle income countries, they do not have colleagues that are easily accessible. So what we're trying to do is also establish perhaps some of this mentorship won't just be academic mentorship. We think a lot of this mentorship will be actually clinically directed. So we're quite excited about that program coming up right now.
I see. So here in the United States, we're definitely not an LMIC country, but it also faces its own challenges in providing service to poor rural communities. So I have myself seen cancer centers that treat 5 to 7 patients per day in a rural community eventually close because of the financial difficulty of maintaining a modern radiation oncology center with low patient volume. And when that happens, the patients have no choice but to make long trips, an hour or more each way, just to receive treatments. But the financial issue is not the only challenge for these rural communities, but also to find qualified staff willing to work and live in these more remote areas. I've tried to find staff for some of these centers, and it's near impossible. No one wants to be in those areas unless that's where they were born, let's say. So are these underserved communities also on the MPWB radar?
In a sense, they are. In a sense, no. But I think you point out something where one of the things that we're seeing as we establish more of our interactions with colleagues in various settings, we have a lot that we can learn, in fact, from colleagues who are working in centers that have lower resources or fewer resources and have challenges because they are perhaps a rural center in a middle-income country. So we can actually learn some things from these people, and I think that will help us perhaps as we look at how we can serve people in, for example, high-income countries, where especially large high-income countries such as the United States or Canada or Australia, where the centers that are well established, as you say, are in urban centers usually. So perhaps one of the things we can learn how to deal with these things is just through lessons we learn from our colleagues in low and middle income countries. And to the future, I think the tools that we will be able to establish as we reach out virtually to help colleagues in low and middle income countries are the same kind of tools that then we will be able to use as we reach out to our underserved areas in our countries. So I think in the future, there is a lot we can learn that might benefit radiation treatment in our countries. But how that will exactly look, I won't know. And the one thing you point out with people not being willing to go in these centers, that'll always be a struggle. We'll have to figure out how to deal with that.
So, John, are you able to tell us exactly the degree to which the LMICs are underserved when it comes to radiation oncology and its availability for treatment?
It's unfortunate that I cannot show a map on a podcast, because the lack of access really becomes quite clear when you have a map with countries lit up showing how many radiation units they have or how many cancer clinics are available. But I can say that nearly 50 countries in the world have less than one radiation treatment unit per 1 million population. And there's 36 countries in the world where there's no radiation treatment capacity at all. The problem is the problem of access is acute in Africa. But it also extends to Central and North America, the Middle East, through Asia, Eastern Europe. So it is a terrible problem. And it isn't just the access to equipment, Eric, that's the problem. It's also, as we've been discussing, the lack of appropriately trained personnel, be they medical physicists, radiation therapists, radiation oncologists, nurses, all the healthcare professionals that you need in a cancer center. And so that's also a huge deficit. Again, in high-income countries in the world, 50% of patients who are being treated for cancer are treated with radiation therapy at some time in their care. And in much of the world, that just is not available.
So, John, what would it actually cost to bring radiation oncology service up to an acceptable level in these LMICs? What would the total cost be in terms of the cost for equipment and such? And how long would it take to do that?
So this has been looked at by a number of various groups. So the International Atomic Energy Agency has been studying this for quite a while, and various World Health Organizations. But perhaps one of the most complete analyses from about 7 years ago was done by the Union for International Cancer Control through a working group that looked at global access and extending global cancer care. And they estimated that about 4,000 extra machines would be required in the world shortly after their study. And by 2035, there would be a need for another 13,000 megavoltage treatment machines, for another 6,000 plus CT scanners for in terms of equipment. And even as critical, there would be a need for 22,000 more medical physicists, 30,000 more radiation oncologists, and nearly 80,000 more radiation therapists, the people who deliver the treatments and take care of the patients. They would also have to be trained to bring cancer cancer treatment with radiation up to the levels that we think acceptable in high-income countries. So there is a real deficit there. So they did analysis of the costs, and the cost of all these lost lives due to cancer, and estimated that while this was a huge burden, it made financial sense to bring the standards up globally, that it was actually a cost-effective, in the global sense, that we were actually treating these cancers and not just letting people die prematurely, perhaps because they did not have access to the care. The struggle would be how you actually operationalize that when the funding comes from, usually from local governments and in the local setting. The Union Internationale for Cancer Control looked at the economics of this, as I said, and they really came to some very specific costs. And first of all, again, they recognize that worldwide access to radiation therapy is unacceptably low. And the cost to scale up for equipment and the training, that deficit that I've just talked about, from 2015 to 2035, to scale up would cost just under $190 billion. And this sounds like an incredible cost, and is it justifiable? They also looked at what this would save in terms of life years lost in low and middle income countries, and what the economic cost associated with that is. And they concluded that you would save about 27 million life years for cancer patients in low and middle income countries. And the benefit would be over $300 billion. So although an investment to correct this problem is quite high, the benefit economically is there. The struggle, of course, will be where does this money come from to do the work? And so perhaps in the next few years, we just have to be able to help as much as we can in some of the practical issues, such as assisting in the training. And that is the work that Medical Physics for World Benefit is trying to provide some support for.
Sure. And what you said about what COVID has taught us about doing remote work is very true. And today we have the ability to do remote treatment planning, even maybe automated planning. That's coming up. It's not quite here yet, but it's very close. And we have telemedicine. So these kind of tools should be able to help with manpower shortages in the physics and dosimetry arena, especially if coupled with access to experts who can join in remotely over the modern tools that we have.
So one of the problems with radiation therapy is that you do need some critical mass in some way to justify having a piece of equipment and in some way to have enough people that they can provide the service. But as you say, one of the things we can learn is that perhaps especially the personnel critical mass does not have to be constrained that everybody is at the same location. So there is a lot of things that we can do remotely. And, you know, automated treatment planning is something where perhaps in the future, it could be that a patient has to go to a center to get some imaging done to help start the treatment. But then the treatment can be done in a remote center because there is this communication and treatment planning that's done virtually or remotely. So, you know, I think there's a lot that is possible in the future. And there are some very good people that are thinking of this. There's a very strong group at the MD Anderson with Lawrence Court that are working specifically on the treatment planning problem. So, you know, I think as we move forward, we are going to be looking at how we extend radiation therapy to the full under-resourced environment, not just the under-resourced environment in low-income countries.
Sure. Do you find that it's easy to get medical physicists engaged in these broader concerns? I think you said you have 120-something members right now.
Yes, I think it was more like 230.
Oh, 230. Yes. I'm sorry. So 230 is pretty good. I think the membership in the AAPM is maybe between 4,000 and 5,000. So there are still a lot of people out there. But do you find that, you know, I am no longer in a clinic as I work as a consultant, but when I was in the clinic, I was busy all day with very little time left over for anything. So do you find that people are busy enough with what they have in front of them, plus their family and so on, that really the volunteers for the MPWB is mostly either near retired or retired people such as yourself? Do you think there is a way to have the routine medical physicists find time to commit to something like this?
Okay, so the short answer to your question is that, in fact, this is work that any medical physicist can do, but there are challenges. It was thought at one point that much of our help would come from retired members who had the ability to give a lot of time, because the model for some of the projects we were involved with did require somebody to travel for quite a bit of time to some center. And that travel would often be unsupported. And, you know, it might be a week, it might be 2 weeks, it might be a month. And how do you fit that in when you're a clinical physicist in the middle of your career? Also, physicists who are going through their career they want to have some recognition for the work that they're that they're involved with and that they're spending their efforts on. And I think one change is that global initiatives have become important concerns in the community. So perhaps 10 years ago, somebody interested in global medical physics would have had a bit of a barrier because they wouldn't have had the support of their academic institution or their clinic. Now there is great interest in helping globally. And as you said earlier, the AAPM and ASTRO and various oncology groups that are out there have very much been promoting global work as good career paths. So we're getting a bit of a change there, that this is a viable thing that that you can be spending your work on. The other thing that we've seen changed is this this move to mentorship projects or to the open syllabus project. These are projects that a physicist doesn't have to devote 3 days a week or a whole week of their vacation to. These are all things that you can participate in with a few hours every couple of weeks, maybe an hour every 2 weeks where you meet with your mentee. And so it's actually opening up the ability for medical physicists to get involved. And I would even say that for some medical physicists who are in smaller centers who have a motivation to help, we might be providing some opportunities that they would not have had in their regular environment. A lot of medical physics training, unfortunately, I think, has been directed more to bigger centers that can achieve the requirements of the CAMPEP accreditation programs. So, you know, you need to have a certain critical mass to be able to be a CAMPEP training program. So a lot of medical physicists do not have an opportunity to help train younger physicists or help support physicists who just need a voice to hear their concerns and work through problems. And perhaps through some of the programs that Medical Physics for World Benefit is starting, we can actually give people an opportunity to become mentors, to become trainers, to get involved in work that helps others. And as I pointed out at the beginning of our chat, I think the achievement in my career that I'm most proud of is that I was able to train up and introduce people to medical physics, and know that these people then went out and have benefited patients in their various centers. I mean, that is very uplifting. And perhaps through some of these virtual programs, these remote programs that we're doing, we can actually get more medical physicists engaged without them having to commit their whole careers to this project.
Well, do you think it would be possible for some centers, maybe with Medical Physics for World Benefit, discussing it with them, to even carve out a certain amount of time that their employed physicists are permitted to assist with these global oncology efforts? I think that would be a good thing for a center to say it does, and it may even encourage people to work with some centers. Has that been explored at all?
We're just beginning to think about those things as we begin to learn the tools that are suddenly have become available with all the remote interactions that have been happening in the last year or two. I think this is very possible. So, for example, maybe a center could every now and then have a live session when they are doing their end of day quality assurance tests on some particular delivery or on some dosimetry concern. And, you know, maybe do a live session with some colleagues in a low and middle income country that just want to observe what's going on.
Yeah, that's so a great idea.
You know, you can really begin to blue sky some of the opportunities that could be available to us.
Sure. So a more difficult question for you, John. I, along with a lot of other people, of course, we read news reports how in some African countries, there's perhaps only one LINAC available, if even one, for providing radiation oncology. And when that LINAC goes down, as LINACs do, the attendant difficulties faced by the patients who actually need their treatments to be uninterrupted. First, how much of what we read about how bad it is in some of these countries, how much of that is actually the case in terms of statistics, if you have that on hand? And if what MPWB focuses on doing is offering expertise and methods for gaining knowledge through your open syllabus, for example, that only becomes really very useful if there is infrastructure available to apply it to. So what's the solution here? You can't help anyone if they don't even have a LINAC. So what's the solution?
Eric, what you say is true. It is a problem in much of the world. In fact, first of all, I mean, every second country in Africa has no radiation treatment unit at all, and they're trying to get those treatment units up, and they're sometimes trying to do that very quickly. So this is a real problem, not only in Africa, but also in many other low and middle income countries. In fact, I heard a very good talk this week. There was the International Conference on the Advancement of Radiation Oncology, at the International Atomic Energy Agency this week. And there was a very good talk by a radiation oncologist from Mongolia talking about some of the struggles exactly along the lines of what you were saying. Is, you know, they have some equipment, they had struggles installing the equipment because of things that happen, and then they have struggles maintaining the equipment. And it's a complicated problem, but part of the solution is making sure that when people start the work on a clinic, that they're fully informed on what they have to set up. So really make people understand not only the physical resources and the equipment resources they need, but also the person resources and the workers that they need to be able to start up a clinic, maintain a clinic, and sustain the clinic. And I think that's one place where Medical Physics for World Benefit is also trying to help. Many of our ad hoc requests are, how do we move forward to do something? And some of the news we have given to the people asking us for help has been the hard news that, well, you know, have you really thought this through yet? Here is what you really have to do to make sure that there's going to be success here. And here are the type of people that you have to make sure that you're going to engage as you establish your clinic. So the work that Medical Physics for World Benefit is trying to do here is to educate support organizations, educate the governments that are trying to bring things on, and educate the local people who are coming to us for help so that they can better set themselves up for success. And sometimes it is a bit of a discussion of, you know, you have the ability to get this used linear accelerator that somebody is offering you for very little money, but have you considered how you are going to support this equipment that the vendor perhaps only is giving another 5 years to, and how are you going to maintain this equipment, and are the spare parts available? And we can help people think about the problems that they haven't thought of. Is that the way to say it, maybe?
Yep, that makes perfect sense. But speaking, following up on what you just said with regards to equipment, one route for equipment which is no longer used here in the United States, such as cobalt machines that you mentioned, or just very old Linux, is for them to find their way to the LMICs. So for a country which has no capability at all, it would seem that any equipment received would be better than none. But at Astro last year, when they were discussing LMICs, I heard a comment someone made, which was, we're essentially then sending to these nations discarded equipment, equipment that we don't want, which because they cannot provide the most modern therapies. And is that what we should really be doing for these LMICs, sending the stuff we don't really want or not? It seems like a quandary. What's your feelings about that?
Well, it depends a lot on what type of equipment we're talking about. Attitudes on donated equipment have very much changed over the last little while. And this is a very good thing because, in fact, the World Health Organization estimates that in the past, only about 10 to 30% of equipment donated to LMICs would actually become operational. And not only would that sometimes be because of the condition of the equipment or, the fact that the equipment was near end of life, but also the fact that the people that would be able to use the equipment and maintain the equipment haven't been trained up, as I discussed a little bit earlier. So it depends a lot on the type of equipment, because you really have to make sure that the personnel are trained to install and commission and maintain it. And so the one thing we can do is, again, just make people very aware of the caveats on taking donated equipment. On the other hand, if it's, for example, a dosimetry system or perhaps even a treatment planning system, that might be something that they can use. So again, what we have to make sure is, if something like that is being donated, that there is support to make sure that that equipment is brought on. And again, as I said a little bit earlier, we have established some links with the AAPM donation committee and the IOMP on helping support when equipment is donated, that we can provide some expertise to the location receiving the equipment. So that's something that we're working on. I think the other thing that I'd like to bring up is I'd like to give a challenge to our community a little bit on what is suitable equipment and what isn't suitable equipment. And for example, you mentioned the Cobalt 60 unit. The Cobalt 60 unit is a unit that we do not use very much anymore in high-income countries, although at one time cobalt MRI unit from ViewRay was the highest-end radiation therapy device that was available throughout the world, I would argue. So perhaps what we also should be thinking about is how do we redesign some of these pieces of equipment so that they come up to the standards that we need. In Kingston, we've done considerable work on cobalt to show that it actually can deliver modern radiation therapy. There are some constraints, in particular with how long it takes to deliver a treatment, but you can deliver a very good treatment to a patient depending on what you are actually trying to do.
And I am going to ask you right after this then, for the development of cobalt machines, not with MRI, but just say making them more sophisticated in terms of what they can do, this would really require the vendors to put some R&D into that, which costs money. And at the end of the day, they have to recoup that money and make a profit. If it's not just going to be the academic centers fiddling with these machines that solve the problem. So is there a realistic route to have vendors go back and apply themselves to these problems with regards to cobalt?
Yes, and I think with regards to cobalt, we are seeing that already in the world. I think what happened at one time was there was a fear to advance cobalt too much because it was felt that it was a basic technology that you wanted to keep as simple as possible in an environment where there might not be a lot of highly trained staff to make the machine work. So there I think for a while there was actually a suppression on the development, if I might say, of a cobalt unit to keep it as simple as possible. And I think the vendors kind of cut off their foot by taking that approach. And now they are beginning to see that they do have to move this technology forward. So there is a company in India that has some novel designs for their cobalt unit. I know that the cobalt unit that comes out of Canada in Canada is also looking to put on some of the tools that enables that unit to do better shielding, better confirmation of the treatment, some image guidance. And I believe there's also a Czechoslovakian company that's trying to do this development. So I think they have seen that they have to show that these machines can do modern therapy. They have to make machines that can do modern therapy. And I think perhaps that's a great development that's happening right now. One thing haven't really said, there are some other advantages to cobalt, in particular in centers where you do not have very good electrical infrastructure, or you don't have very good water supply for cooling of machines. A cobalt unit has some good advantages that make them attractive in those centers. But again, it's not old cobalt units that we should be giving to these centers. They need to be these modernized units. And I do believe that companies are realizing that they have to make these developments.
And the opportunity to purchase these units does exist in some of these LMIC countries. They will be able to afford them at whatever the price point is.
From studies that I've seen, a cobalt unit over its lifetime costs about half of what a LINAC would cost. So there are perhaps some ways that those funds might become more available. It will be a struggle because I think because of the lack of development of cobalt in the past, it does have a little bit of a bad name. And I should say that there are other approaches. And in fact, Medical Physics for World Benefit works on a consortium that has a number of groups involved, including the people at CERN that you mentioned earlier, in trying to redesign linear accelerators so that perhaps they are more robust and more useful in countries without a lot of infrastructure. So I guess the answer to all of this, as I've been kind of wandering around the map, is there needs to be development that is more specific to providing basic radiation therapy in the low and middle income countries. And people are beginning to look at this from both a cobalt side and from a linear accelerator side. And this is the advantage. I don't think all of the advantages are that our highest end machines have to be in these settings. In fact, they wouldn't be maintainable.
I see. So given that you understand this and what you say sounds really reasonable, John, is MPWB then trying to promote that concept?
I should be very careful here in that some of the things I've said are my personal views. They are not the views of all my colleagues. So I should be a little bit careful there. But again, we have been advocates in trying to make sure that when people make decisions, they have the information that they need to make the correct decision. But we would not be a group that really advocates, this is the solution for you. We just try to give them the information that they need to make the appropriate decision.
Coming back to the goals of medical physics for world benefit, as the new president of this organization, are you completely free to set those goals, or is it always in conjunction with the board? How much do you define the culture of the organization during your tenure? And also, how long is the tenure of the presidency?
If one is president of the board, one is actually on the board for 6 years. So we have kind of a transition where you are president-elect, and that was my 2 years to be able to become familiar with the organization and where we were going. I will have 2 years as president and then 2 years as past president. So I have a bit of an opportunity to help as the organization moves forward. We do work as a board. And so I suspect there are some things that I can give a little bit more flavor to, because I'm bringing different ideas to the organization than were considered at the beginning. But, you know, that's every member of the board has that ability to bring things forward and move things forward. But in fact, we just came through a strategic planning in the last 2 months. And that was a really good exercise where we looked at what we have been doing well and what we have to improve on in the near future. And that was a very good exercise. And I think in my term as president, I'm just going to make sure that we see the conclusions of that strategic plan go forward. And the main things that came out of this project were, how do we maintain the work that we are doing? How do we get some of these projects off the ground and engaging more of our membership so that the full membership of the organization can get involved and see that they're involved in an organization that is moving forward? And also, how do we still deal with the ad hoc requests that come periodically? So it does not rely on me. It's a great organization that has some very committed people in it. So we are all engaged to moving it forward, but I'll give it a little bit of flavor.
Is it all volunteer, or are some people in the organization paid, I don't know if you call it a salary, but paid something for their time?
Right now, it is all organized. We get a little bit of support from an office that helps the Canadian Organization of Medical Physics with their activities. But it's a volunteer organization. And until we have grown to a stage where our finances are able to fully support staff, it's the goodwill and the hard work of the volunteers that's keeping us going.
So there's an abundance of information available on the internet today about everything. And you can find mountains of conflicting claims about what science knows or doesn't know, about what's real and what's fake news. Does the current lack of credibility in the media, at least here in the United States, affect the ability of medical physics for world benefit to get the word out?
I do not think that science distrust is a problem for the most part for the issues that we've been discussing. Much of medical physics for world benefits work is directed to healthcare professionals, hospital administrators, perhaps governmental civil servants, and they're relatively well informed. That's not to say these folk cannot fall for fake news, but on the issues that we're talking to, these aren't the usual topics for trolls and conspiracy advocates and such. So there's enough consistent reporting from multiple agencies that this particular problem isn't an issue. But I will say that disbelief in science may intensify the problem that cancer patients themselves might not always present themselves for diagnostic assessment or for treatment. Then patient attitudes may be influenced by fake news and science skepticism. But as I understand it, many colleagues and cancer activists globally are working to change patient attitudes also. It's not something that we are directing Medical Physics for World Benefits attention to, but we have many good colleagues who are working on that particular problem.
Sure. I'm sure that lack of education plays a huge role in terms of people seeing the relevant experts for their care.
Mm-hmm.
If there are medical physicists listening to this podcast who feel motivated and want to do their part in helping the effort for global oncology, what steps would you suggest they take in general, and should they be contacting MPWB?
Yeah, well, I would encourage listeners to consider at whatever stage of their career they are at. If they're well-established, if they're just beginning their careers, to consider getting involved in global issues. I think there is a real need in the world for our expertise and our help to extend the accessibility of radiation therapy. So I would really encourage the listeners to get involved. That type of work, I think, is really coming to the forefront of a good way to spend one's efforts as they look at a career path, and if they're concerned about advancement as an academic or whatever, having global interests is a well-recognized focus for somebody's work. So I can encourage them that way. And definitely they're welcome to contact us. We have a website at www.mpwb.org. It has a lot more information on the organization and where we're going. It has better descriptions of some of the things we've discussed today, much more eloquent than I can be. So, you know, they can go and take a look at the organization. Membership fees are tax deductible in Canada and in the USA. So becoming a member is not onerous, and it will keep you and the listener informed on our initiatives. So I would very much encourage them to look at our website, give it a read, and they can feel free to email us. There is an email address on the website, and we'll answer them if they have any specific questions.
I became aware of Medical Physics for World Benefit just last year at the ASTRO meeting, when one of the slides presented had your logo on it. Prior to that, and it's probably more a reflection of me, John, and my not paying attention to the world around me, but prior to that, I hadn't heard of your organization. Is there a lot of effort out there to make sure that the medical physicists in the AAPM and in the Canadian organizations know that you exist? What are you doing in that regard?
Yes, well, so for the last few years, at every annual meeting of the Canadian Organization of Medical Physicists or of the American Association of Physicists in Medicine, there has been a Medical Physics for World Benefit session where we have had an opportunity to describe our organization to attendees of those sessions. In fact, those sessions have been very well received for the most part. We often get particularly young medical physicists with a strong desire to help coming to those sessions and asking some very good questions. So we've been trying to get the word out that way. The AAPM has just set up an international council in their committee structure. They actually have now a stronger focus of a particular group looking at international concerns. And we have a number of Medical Physics for World Benefit board members that are on that that council to help provide a liaison so that we are working together. And I think this this global interest has really been growing in the last few years. And as that has been growing, we definitely are making sure that organizations are aware of our work and that we can actually be a conduit for getting organizations to talking with each other and moving forward. Again, because we can focus on these global issues, we are able sometimes to provide some stronger help to other organizations that are much bigger and have broader scope.
Well, hopefully this podcast helps a bit. From our statistics, I know we get about 1,000 people listening to them, which is not as big as Joe Rogan, who gets 100 million people, but for our field, 1,000 ain't bad. So hopefully you will get some new folks looking into your organization after this. John, thank you for a very informative and interesting discussion. I enjoyed it very much. It was very revealing. And I look forward to perhaps speaking with you again in a year to see what progress your group has made, and you in particular as the new president.
Well, thank you very much, Eric. I thank you for the opportunity. I'm sure there are many things that I should have said that I didn't say. And so if we have an opportunity to chat again in a year's time, perhaps I'll be more knowledgeable with a year's further experience and somewhat more eloquent.
I see you in 1 year in February 2022 then.
I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you to our guest, Dr. John Schreiner, for joining us to discuss global oncology and medical physics for world benefit. To learn more about medical physics for world benefit or to donate to their cause, visit www.mpwb.org or find them on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. As always, if you or someone you know has a project or expertise you think would make a good topic for our show, visit versantphysics.com/podcast and introduce yourself. We'd love to hear from you.